You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, I welcome Tracy R. Twyman to the show. Tracy is a prolific author and commentator who approaches historical research from an esoteric perspective. She is probably best known for her book, The Merovingian Mythos, and her underground cult magazine, Dagobert's Revenge. In recent years, she has pioneered what she calls alchonomics, the study of relationship between alchemy, economics, and the evolution of money through the ages. Her works on this subject include her 2005 book, Solomon's Treasure, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money, and her most recent book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. She has appeared on several radio shows, television shows, and film documentaries. Most notably, she has been interviewed on National Geographic's Is It Real? Da Vinci's Code, and Jesse Ventura's Conspiracy Theory in 2012, and the documentary film Bloodline in 2008. She has also appeared repeatedly on Coast to Coast AM with our good friend George Nuri, and Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis. You can find out more about her and find her books that she is now signing for people who would like to have a signature on www.tracytwyman.com. So let's welcome her to the show now. Hi, Tracy. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Lance. Thanks. I'd like to mention, too, there's actually two books that have come out since Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. So there's Clock Shavings, which is sort of a memoir about Ouija board seances I've done throughout the years.
Okay.
And then the most recent one is Baphomet, the temple mystery unveiled, and so that's really the world's first and most comprehensive book entirely about Baphomet, the concept and the history of that idea of the idol that the Templars were accused of worshiping.
How did you go about researching that book? I imagine it was. There's quite a lot of, not only is it concealed information, and most information is hidden from us, but also with esoteric information, it's often kept in, the secret schools and the mystery schools and so on. And then the rest of it is just destroyed so that people don't find out about it. How did you go about researching that book, and can you tell us more about it?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, it's over 600 pages long. I had to, I've been working on it for probably 8 years or so now, and I had to bring in a friend, actually, to help me finish it because it was just too big of a task. And so Alexander Rivera is the co-author on that. He's an expert on Gnosticism. He's got a website called theaonei.com. So that's theaonei.com. And so he writes, he's got all sorts of esoteric writings about Gnosticism and some interesting ideas actually about Simon Magus and his role in, in the development of Christianity and also Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that guy came and helped me. And the research for it, it took so long because it really is quite a very big idea, and amazingly, one that we found was not very well documented, actually. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, incorrect assumptions made. I think this is just something that you find if you, any topic, if you happen to be the first one
mm-hmm.
in your own modern times to actually
right.
explore that topic.
Right.
It's like you when you try to get to the primary sources and figure out, how did this idea develop over time, it's very important to get it in the right sequence to figure out, okay, was the word Baphomet used by the Templars? Did they themselves refer to this deity by that name? Yes. And, you know, was the meaning of that expounded upon at the time? Not really. So there were assumptions or theories that were placed upon the meaning of the name and the meaning of the rituals that they did to Baphomet at that time, which would have been the early 1300s. And then over time, the idea developed, you know, basically got embellished by people who wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, it's sort of our job to figure out, do the people who are writing about it, are they making this stuff up, or are they really, you know, tapping into the actual meaning of what Baphomet was and what the Templars were doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found that, you know, there were some embellishments, apparently, and we really tracked it down to, it seemed like a lot of the idea had been developed in the early 1800s and mid-1800s. So we all, I think, are familiar with the image of Baphomet, this demon the Knights Templar were accused of worshipping, as being this goat-headed hermaphrodite human.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like a chimera creature. And that image of Baphomet was really solidified, I would say, during the 1800s. So, and it's because of the writings of Eliphas Levi, who was an occultist, and he wrote about what he thought Baphomet was and how he thought that the concept had been continued on through Freemasonry, the mysteries of Freemasonry, and that he really thought the almost all the mysteries, the Western occult mystery schools in his own time, were continuing the you know, the tradition, I guess, of the Templars in a way, and tapping into the same mythos with Baphomet. Basically, he was saying that Baphomet is it's the same as what the alchemists called the, you know, the philosopher's stone, or like, or the universal agent. Really, is a better connection there with the process of alchemy, because in alchemy, the universal agent, as they call it, is the thing that transforms the substance, such as lead, into another substance, you know, gold, usually
in
what we usually think of as alchemy, and so. He was saying that this is the agent that causes that transformation to happen. You know, the name Baphomet could be applied to that. And that, you know, he was basically saying he thought the Templars were doing magic, that the Freemasons were too, and, you know, that all modern Western magicians were doing the same thing as well, using that same power. And he even described it as sort of a plastic that is, you know, plastic as in something that moves, molds itself or conforms itself around, you know, whatever's pressing into it, I guess, right? A substance such as that pervading the entire universe. And, you know, if you can project your will or your, you know, yeah, I guess an impression in your mind and project it onto that plastic substance, you can somehow, you know, recreate that and make that impression upon the universe. So in other words, you know, that's how you manifest your will into reality, is through this substance which he was connecting to Baphomet or the universal agent. And similar writings, actually, in the 1800s about the universal agent in the Masonic writings of Albert Pike. And then he did sort of, Albert Pike also wrote about Baphomet and kind of hinted that it was the same thing too. So you've got Albert Pike, a Masonic writer, kind of backing Eliphas Levi up on that idea that, you know, that's really what Baphomet was. And then what I think is key to our, you know, making some breakthroughs here with modern historical research on this topic, mm-hmm. is that Eliphas Levi was really influenced by this scholarly work that had occurred, that had been published in 1818, just a couple decades before his books came out. And it had been written in Latin by an Orientalist from Vienna, whose name was Joseph Hammer, or von Hammer Purgstall. And he wrote this whole thing in Latin, and he had all these pictures that were all line drawings he had made of artifacts that he had found in private collections, and also in museums and in churches and cathedrals. And all of them had either the cathedrals themselves or the objects originated from cathedrals and places that had been formerly properties of the Templars. So the people that had shown him these artifacts that he was studying all thought that these objects were sort of ritual items that had been used by the Templars, or in some cases there were pictures that were on the sides of buildings and stuff. And so they were saying, these were basically the ritual rooms. They were doing rituals in these, churches. And these are images that they, had on the walls in some of those churches. And then there were other artifacts that were like caskets with, very vivid occult imagery all over them. And very occult, too. It's like, it's not exactly obvious what's going on here in the beginning. You really have to look deep to see what the meaning of all these symbols is. Mm-hmm. And they're all similar. I mean, if you can connect them all, and Joseph von Hammer did try to basically reconstruct a secret doctrine that must have been behind all of these images. And he thought, we're talking about things that were in different places in Austria, France, Germany, several different places throughout Europe. So it's interesting that he was able to find all these different artifacts that could all sort of share the same kind of imagery. And he was saying they show Baphomet, because they show a hermaphroditic being with a goat head, and sometimes with a goat head. And there's writing, that sort of secret writing, and it's encoded in three different languages. Like, they'll write this stuff in one language, but the letters will be the letters from another language, and even those letters will be, transposed so as to form a code. So there's many layers of decoding you have to do to figure out what these inscriptions say. And what they say is stuff about apparently a goddess, that's what it seemed like, called Meat. And so von Hammer wrote about how Meat was really a personification of wisdom. That's the root of the that word Baphomet. So, actually, several authors before him had already theorized that the word Baphomet meant baptism of wisdom.
Huh.
And we find that that's probably the best translation of it, and that that's probably also the name of the ritual that the Templars were doing involving Baphomet. And, originally the confessions they gave described Baphomet as a severed head or an embalmed head, sometimes a skull. Mm-hmm. And, said that the skull would sometimes have multiple faces, or the embalmed head would have multiple faces. So the original descriptions of the idols, that you actually see in the confessions that they made are really specifically about this head. But the objects that von Hammer found, when they were depicting this Meat figure, like I said, it's a hermaphroditic figure, and sometimes in a couple of instances was shown with a goat head. So it's like, that's where that embellishment, or I guess expansion of the concept of Baphomet came from, was von Hammer Purgstall's works, where he said, this is a depiction of Baphomet, and it's not just a head, it's this goddess. And he compared it to, he connected it to Cybele, he's connected it to Sophia, the Gnostic goddess of wisdom.
Right.
And then he, and actually a couple of other authors before him even, had connected this word baptism of wisdom to this reference that had been made in the Corpus Hermeticum. And I guess I'd be guessing at what the the actual date of Corpus Hermeticum is from. It used to be thought of as being ancient, and then people said that, you know, it's probably actually sort of a medieval forgery. But anyway, this is the Corpus Hermeticum is, you know, the basis of what Hermeticism comes from. It's sort of a late antiquity Egyptian, supposedly, origin of, esoteric philosophy. And, you know, it's based on supposedly these writings of Hermes, and who was, you know, the way he's portrayed in these writings, he wasn't just the Greek god of communication and wisdom, but also a sort of a deified king from the ancient past is how they portray him. And they said, anyway, so in the discourses of Hermes in the Corpus Hermeticum, he's talking to his students, teaching them wisdom. And in one case, he told one of his students that there was this bowl of mind or wisdom that God lowered down from heaven so that mankind would compete for the wisdom inside the bowl. And he said that anyone who is brave enough to immerse themselves in the wisdom and felt like they would be able to come out again from that immersion whole, he was basically encouraging people who want to self-initiate into that wisdom to do so, and then also saying, you know, kind of do so at your own risk because it might tear you apart. It's sort of a paraphrasing of the way that this lesson was being given in the Corpus Hermeticum. And that, so what he's talking about there is a baptism of wisdom, being immersed in the wisdom inside the bowl. And I think that's sort of the origin of the term and the idea, and I think that the Templars were probably practicing a corrupt version of that. And so, anyway, I know that's all one really long-winded answer for your question about what that book is about, but I really sort of wanted to explain, you know, how we really did figure out the origin and the whole progression of how this idea developed over time.
Well, now, it brings up a couple of questions in my mind, because I know that Baphomet is presently associated with satanic rituals and with the Illuminati and hand signs and so on and so forth, and many people are doing occult rituals and blood sacrifices and so on. But in those older days, were the people actually able to conjure up these different entities from other realms and command them or use them or learn from them, do you think?
You're talking about during the Templars' time, what they were doing?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it. I mean, that's their confessions are saying, you know, that they're communicating with this thing, that it gave them wisdom, it enabled them to become wealthy. And they did become wealthy, and part of how they became wealthy had to do with setting up an international banking system, which was really the first in history. So it's possible, I theorize, that basically, you know, they did receive the information about how to do that from this severed head. And this is another thing we talk about, actually, is this whole idea of talking to a severed head in divination sessions didn't originate there. It's actually a term, they refer to it in the Bible, it's called teraphim. It's a type of idol. And the traditional way of doing it actually usually is a small boy is sacrificed. Cut his head off, and then you put a parchment that's inscribed with, you know, some sort of magical symbols meant to, have a magical spell effect on the head. They would shove this parchment with the symbols on it into the mouth of the head, and then that would cause it to animate and start speaking. And they'd usually mount it to a plate, and then maybe put it on the wall or something, or on an altar, and then it'll talk to them and prophesy to them. And then there's a tradition that doing this with the head of a prophet is particularly useful, and then you can basically enslave the spirit of the prophet inside the head and just use it, you know, to force it to give you information and and help you supernaturally with things from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we theorized, because the severed head associated with the Templars has always been sort of interpreted as being symbolically connected, or it evokes the imagery of John the Baptist's severed head, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the Templars did invoke John as one of their particular patrons, and then the Freemasons, who, you know, afterwards sort of took up the mantle of Templars and said, sort of tried to connect themselves to it and act like they're continuing the Templar tradition, they also invoked the two Johns, John the Baptist and John the Evangelist, as their two patrons. And it seemed to us like they were really, you know, this tradition is sort of pointing to the importance of John. So we started thinking about the story of John and having his head cut off. I mean, a lot of people have written and said, well, maybe, you know, the Templars actually had John's head, and that's what they were using. That's what Baphomet was.
Mm-hmm,
and really, it's not something that we would reject, because the Templars were, and actually all the crusading orders, all the military orders that were involved in the Crusades, they were all involved in the trading of relics.
Right,
so,
right.
So there's several different heads of John the Baptist floating around, two of them, at least, we were able to trace to the traditions about them and how they got to the places where that they're at. The traditions say that, you know, crusading knights brought them. So, I think there's a direct possible connection with at least two of the alleged heads of John the Baptist, that they might have been discovered by the Templars. Well, I think it's entirely possible that the Baphomet head was John, or they thought it was, at any rate, and that the reason why they had it was because not only did they want to use it as a teraph, you know, for a divination head, but maybe it had already been made into one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because when you look at the story of John and his death, you look at that family, Herod's family. They were converted Jews. You know, they had a very recent pagan tradition in their past,
mm-hmm.
and doing sort of magical rituals of this sort is something that was already associated with their family and their dynasty.
Wow.
And sort of the behavior that you see described there of the mother asking for the severed head on a plate, just the way a teraph would be presented, and then the daughter going in and doing the sexy dance to obtain that from her father-in-law, it all seems like sort of a ritual to me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They never really explain. I mean, obviously, the story is that Herodias was angry at John and wanted this done. But there's also, you know, you just kind of wonder why exactly that? Why such a grisly death? Why did she want the head? Why did she actually want to see it and on a plate like that? Why did she ask for it like that?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It just seems to me quite possible that she wanted to use it. He was a prophet. And, there's a tradition that if you use a prophet's head, then it's even more useful to have.
You can make a bigger profit.
Exactly. So, that's what I think might be going on there. And your question about, were there these sort of what we consider satanic rituals around Baphomet at that time? Really, I think so. And really what I think our book proves, and what I think is so unique about our book, really saying that this is the origin of Satanism, or that what we think of as Satanism,
mm-hmm.
very much is connected to this tradition that the Templars started. It comes from the confessions of the Templars. So that, you know, you can even say that maybe the Templars were lying. They were being tortured. You know, maybe they just said what their captors wanted to hear. Well, it still turned into the tradition of the Templars. And that tradition then was continued on by different satanic cults and, you know, other occult groups. Now, I mean, Freemasons aren't Satanists. I don't think that necessarily. There's some crossover there. A lot of Satanists are Freemasons, but that doesn't mean Freemasons are satanic. But
mm-hmm.
there's plenty of satanic groups that, I mean, I would say really are, you know, that. That's exactly what they are. And several of them invoke Baphomet directly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You see it in the music industry all the time as well.
Yeah, I mean, in modern times, you can see why. I mean, the whole thing breaks down in modern times. Like, you can't trace the idea anymore. It becomes popular in the 60s with Anton LaVey, and then, you know, everyone's using it from that point onward. So, I'm not saying that, you know, just because you see, you know, Kesha or Katy Perry or someone using this imagery, that they're necessarily, you know, initiated into the Templars' secrets or anything. You know, it's just everyone's using it now.
Right,
But the development of Satanism, you know, it didn't just come out and call itself Satanism. You know, it was it developed over time. It was connected to old Dionysian cults that did not die out at all during early Christianity. In fact, what's interesting is, like, early Christianity actually looks like a lot of it was these pseudo Dionysian cults. And you had these Gnostic groups, you know, what we're calling Gnostic now, all these different heretical groups flourishing at the same time as, you know, the earliest Christian groups. Some of these Gnostic groups were Christian. They were using, you know, Christian ideas and imagery. They considered themselves Christian. And then, you know, the writers at the time documenting the heresies, a lot of them didn't differentiate between these groups. So sometimes when they're writing about groups that are getting involved in group sex rituals and the sacrifice of babies, eating the flesh of the sacrificed babies, these are all rituals that we saw associated over and over again with these types of groups, and the same accusations were made against the Templars. Well, in the early days of Christianity, people would sometimes write and say that this is what the Christians are doing. Because they're describing both, you know, the Gnostic cults and the Christian Gnostic cults and the Christian cults, all, you know, from their point of view, they're just surrounded by all these different groups, and they, and all the rumors they hear about are all these sort of sick rituals that they're doing. So, and it's really not clear, you know. We think now that that seems like, oh, that's very anti-Christian. But what is Christian got developed later. You know, the actual definition of it really got solidified over over a period of several hundred years after
Christ. So, wasn't that the Council of Nicaea that pretty much assembled what they wanted to be in the Bible and what they rejected?
That was one of them. Yeah, there were several different councils where they decided on what the canon was, and there was more stuff that was rejected actually than that made it in. So. What Christianity was is in the old days is really ambiguous. So, it's interesting. I mean, when you look at some of these medieval Christian churches in Europe, you see tons of phallic imagery and Dionysian imagery mixed in with the Christian symbols. And to the point where, again, it's like, maybe this was what Christianity was for a while until it got, you know, fine-tuned into what it is now.
Well, it's in the Catholic Church in the form of obelisks and staffs and all kinds of other phallic symbols. And in Washington, D.C., and, you know, in the Masonic creations. So it's still carried through everywhere. It's just not quite as obvious. And those are supposed to be devices that actually work at and are used for collecting energy, and they shift the energy around from place to place, and it's collected in various places, as I understand it.
So, yeah, I mean, who knows what was really going on? It's so interesting to think about, really, you know, how the Knights Templar, their story really starts while all this stuff is still solidifying, in a way.
Right.
I mean, you know, maybe the canon of the Bible has been decided, but the way Christianity is being practiced in a practical level, you know, from church to church, is still changing and still quite different than what it is now. So, you know, you had at the time, contemporary with the Templars, crusades being fought not necessarily by the church, but by local states against heretics. and you have the popes writing bulls against heretics and describing what they are supposedly doing. So one of the bulls, I think it was from Leo the Ninth. I hope I'm getting this right. There's a couple different bulls from popes that deal with the Templars, and then I think it's Leo Ninth. Gosh, I hope I'm getting this right. It's in the book. Actually, there's an excerpt from about exactly what I'm talking about on my website, TracyRTwyman.com. If I'm getting one of the details wrong, you can just read the excerpt yourself on the website, and you can see what the truth is exactly. One of the popes described the rituals done by a group, I believe, was the Waldensians. Which is sort of similar to the Cathars, a sort of heretical quasi-Christian sect that was operating during this time. But their rituals are being described. It sounds like, what we think of as Satanism now. He was saying that they would get into a room and they would invoke this giant cat. This cat would appear. A giant black cat. And would come down from the ceiling and start talking to them and giving them orders, leading them in this liturgy. And they would go through, reciting all of these prayers to the cat and I think to the devil in general, or at least that's how the Pope is describing it, right? And then they would start doing orgies. And then after the orgies, some of the women would get pregnant, and then they do another ritual, killing the child, burning the body down to ashes, and then they would use the ashes either in a paste that they would use for magical purposes, rubbing it on their body, or sometimes they would drink it. So, and all of this detail is described by the Pope. He describes it every detail, and so we don't know. Again, you can see a lot of continuity here about the charges, right? You've got the same accusations being made by heretical Christian groups and even, according to some chronicles, Christian groups doing the same types of rituals. Then later on, those accusations are given to the Templars. And also, pretty much at the same time, contemporary with that, you've got similar accusations being made against Jews in certain places where, we're all familiar with the so-called blood libel, where, Christians will, in a certain town in Europe, will accuse the Jews in their area of sacrificing babies and eating them. And the ritual being described is very similar, really, to what I just said, the Templars were accused of. So over and over again, you have groups that are being maligned in one way or another and being prosecuted for heresy or witchcraft or something, and the descriptions of what they're doing are almost the same each time. So you can look at it two ways, there's a tradition being passed on from each one of these groups, or maybe, this just the people making the accusations are copying people from previous generations and applying the same accusations. I don't know actually which is true, but what I think is it's maybe a little bit of both, and this is why I was saying that the accusations made against the Templars really influenced what later generations of occultists chose to really do in their own rituals. So, the stuff that I'm describing the Pope accusing people of, I don't necessarily think those groups, like the Waldensians, were necessarily copying the Templars, but it's interesting they're all doing the same stuff, allegedly, at the same time. If you've got Templars, Freemasons, do rituals that sort of invoke imagery that I would think is connected to Baphomet, and we go into that a bit in the book. But, say that Freemasons are doing any of these sort of, baby-eating rituals or anything. I don't have any of that evidence. But then there's these other groups, like I talked about, Anton LaVey and modern satanic groups. And really, you could even go back to the 1800s and actually even 1700s, some of the descriptions of people, like there have been Catholic priests and noblemen in Europe and other individuals who have been prosecuted and confessed to participating in these things called black masses, which is basically, you know, it's the Catholic mass only in reverse with all the symbolism reversed and even the words reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really being done, you know, by Satanists, and they're trying to sort of denigrate God and invoke the devil. And the black mass description often involves the same stuff.
Well, it does seem that that the Catholic Church is very much aligned with some of that, some of those rituals, and we know that there's also a black pope. There's a white pope and a black pope. So, and the white pope is uses all kinds of. I mean, there isn't anything he does that isn't basically based on some kind of occult mysticism or numerology or Illuminati symbols, or you know, everything is done intentionally and for a reason and at the right time, and it's all about timing. So they're definitely working on controlling not just their masses, but all the masses, and that seems to be a common thread amongst all those who are high enough in the scheme of things to have some level of control. They all seem to want to play God.
Well, yeah, I was sort of mystified by the role of the church in this story of the Templars, because obviously they chartered the Templars and, you know, gave them their power. The Templars were able to do what they did in terms of amassing power because they were granted basically immunity from any authority by except for the Pope himself. That's the way their charter was written. So, you know, they would set up all these preceptories, you know, different headquarters in different places in Europe, and, you know, they basically, you know, they weren't paying taxes, and they weren't, and they were running their own kind of churches, too. In fact, one of the things
sounds like the Federal Reserve.
one of the things they were doing is they would take in all of these excommunicants, so people that the church had already thrown out.
Oh.
They would say, well, come on over here and you can have a Christian burial and, you know, we'll marry you and whatever else you want. So they were kind of taking rejected customers away from the church and is sort of challenging their authority in a way. And, you know, and then they would, like, they were, you know, even from the beginning, they were quite arrogant, really. But, you know, they would loan local kings and noblemen money and then, you know, basically control them. So, you know, you wonder what did the church know about all this? And then, of course, like I'm describing, you know, the development of Christianity leaves a lot of holes in the story. So, at the time that the Templars were chartered, was Christianity really the same as we think of it now? In other words, was it involving yourself in quasi Dionysian sex rituals in church normal back then?
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe
we just don't realize it because of the way that the history has been misreported. Which, I mean, it may seem kind of shocking to you, to the listener, but a lot of the stuff in the book kind of points to that, and a lot of the things that I've learned even since finishing the book point to that even more, to the point
where
make
sense.
I'm almost... yeah.
Because they had no morality and no conscience, and basically they were all just, doing what was in their own best interest. So if the Templars had amassed great fortune and power, then of course it would be reasonable to expect the church to bring them down and get the booty,
and which they did eventually do. And then, it was really the King of France that brought them down. But at that time, the papacy apparently was very much under the control of the French crown.
Right.
It was a very weird period in history when, the previous pope had been accused by that very same French king and his predecessor of being a witch. And they had actually, Boniface, one of the Bonifaces, actually had to exhume his body. They chose to exhume his body and put that body on trial for witchcraft. It was so weird. And this is just a few years, a couple years, literally 1 to 2 years before the Templar's arrest.
So
the atmosphere when all this stuff happened is just such a strange period in time. And then the way the church acts about it now is very strange too, because for years the story has sort of been that the Templars were prosecuted by the King of France, but the church was really in on it too. French crown was kind of in control. And then the story really has always been, well, it was trumped up charges and they confessed under torture. But it's always been sort of ambiguous, and I think probably, makes the church look bad that they allowed themselves to be led into, basically sacrificing their own. Mm-hmm. And allowing the Templars to be accused of things, and they didn't defend them at all. But then recently, in the last 10 years or so, the Vatican itself has released new documents, what they claim, the clean documents that are, from the times of the Templars that they just now discovered 10 years ago in their own archives. And so
they just discovered it.
Yeah, there was one. So it's called Chinon parchment, and this woman supposedly working for the Vatican discovered it in their library in 2001, and then it took her a few years to publish a report about it. So they didn't mention it for years and years, and when they did, it was part of a press release for a book that they timed to come out on the anniversary of the Templar arrest. And so what's really interesting, though, is it was presented to the press as though this exonerates the Templars. And what it says is that in addition to the king's trial, where he obtained confessions from the Templars, that the Pope also had his own private set of trials and mm-hmm. actually obtained the same confessions, but supposedly without torture.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's weird because that doesn't go along with the headline. The headline is, this document exonerates the Templars. Mm-hmm. And then when you read it, it says, oh, they gave the same confessions, which, by the way, are they confessed to spitting on the cross, denying Christ, kissing one another's butts and penises, and then agreeing verbally that they would, instead of having sex with women, have sex with each other.
Oh, well,
and they
we've known about
this.
That okay. for thousands of years.
So they confess this stuff. The new documentation that the church puts out says that they confessed it, and yet the headline that they write says that it somehow exonerates them. It doesn't at all. When you read the details, what it says is that the Pope tried these guys himself, basically, and then he issued a pardon. So, this is what priests do. They hear a confession, and then they forgive you. They tell you, how many Hail Marys to do or whatever, and then
right.
and then they forgive you. And so that's what it was. And it was, the church puts this out there. And the first editions of the book were in Italian, so I don't think any of the English journalists writing about it actually knew what the book said. And they just repeated the headline.
Right.
So the funny thing is, this is in books, this is in newspapers, this is part of the common thought about the Templars is, the whole story's changed now because the Vatican said that they're exonerated.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't. And this is part of the process. You were asking about how I did my research, okay? Things like this, you have to dig and dig and dig to figure out what something actually says.
Yeah,
and then it doesn't fit what the mainstream thought is.
Wow, an amazing feat and task, and I certainly give you kudos and credit for having done it because, that is something that that's why it hadn't been done until now. Nobody else wanted to do the digging, and I'm sure that I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but it sounds fascinating. And there's another book. I'm not trying to divert us off of this book because it's a really fascinating story and deserves to be brought into the light. But then there's another book you wrote. You've written more than one or two, three books, and I was gleaning some of it today, and it's called Mind-Controlled Sex Slaves and the CIA. And I thought that was kind of an interesting, assemblage of information that goes into MK Ultra and the mind-washing and the brainwashing and the fragmentation and the rape and the, you know, the compartmentalization of the mind. That should be a book that everybody would want to read, because the CIA is still in existence, and as I've heard, that it is completely compartmentalized, and that it's been infiltrated by just about every cabal in the world, and some forces from other countries run certain aspects of it, and some forces from other countries run other aspects. And the Illuminati uses them. I mean, all of these three-letter agencies seem to be catch-alls for the worst of the worst that will do literally anything, and nobody knows, because nobody knows what the right hand is doing.
You know, what's interesting is actually in the research we did, which involved translating that Latin document that I told you about that was written in 1818. Okay, mm-hmm. So we had that translated to English, which no one had done, and all the people writing about this document is referred to in every book about the Templars.
Huh.
None of those writers, almost none of them, have actually read it.
Wow.
And so we've read it, and we actually also found some of the artifacts that are referred to in the book that other writers have said were forgeries and didn't exist. We found them in the British Museum, some of them.
Nice.
So that's interesting. We were able to obtain that. But so it's part of the translation. There's this passage in there that talks about the purpose for these rituals that the Templars were doing. And, of course, this guy is writing sort of fresh off of French Revolution times.
Okay.
And so that's what was in his mind at the time. And he was talking about how political conspiracies work and that... part of the point in a society such as the Templars and a secret group like this, part of the point of the initiation rituals that they do and having these rituals involve crimes like, in modern times, raping children is a crime. I'm not sure it was in Templar times, but killing them was. But killing them was, okay? At any rate,
and eating their hearts and so on and so forth.
It's certainly something that was probably frowned upon, at least by some aspect of society, I would think. And
a few raised eyebrows.
And so, he's saying, Hammer Perkstall was saying at the time that part of the purpose of this is to mutually assured destruction, that mm-hmm. everyone who participates in something like this has dirt on all the other members.
Yeah.
And so not only does it make you loyal to the group,
yep.
but then it also lowers your inhibition so that next you're willing to do even bigger crimes.
That's right.
Once you've killed some children in a ritual to the Templars, then going into Jerusalem and slaughtering the entire population is no big deal. You're ready for that. After
Skull and Bones 3-2-2. That's the whole modus operandi of that operation, and most secret societies, is that it's basically by invitation only, and then they have to tell everything that they've ever done. And I heard that they had to, one of the initiations was that they had to masturbate on a table that was in the center of the room, and there were several tiers above where the other members could watch and listen. And of course, everything's taped, so you could go back and see what so-and-so had said and done. And so you all have all the dirt on everyone else, and nobody is going, that alone is enough to keep them in line without having to threaten death or blackmail. Although they use those
right.
tactics frequently. That's a common tactics.
So I think they did it just recently. I mean, you noticed the establishment, the Republican establishment, and they're really connected to a larger establishment beyond Republicanism, that they decided to push out Marco Rubio, you know, and try to promote him as, you know, he should be the new front runner. And simultaneously, as their controlled media is promoting Marco Rubio in a new way and trying to get everyone to go along with that, at the same time, this new story appears that, oh, he was involved in these gay foam parties when he was in college, and he's really gay and part of the whole, you know, casual
word.
Sex community, and is on. They actually showed photos of him at these things. You can see his head poking up over the foam.
Huh.
And, you know, what it is to me, I saw that, and I'm like, okay, they're promoting Marco Rubio, and at the same time, they're putting that out there, letting him know, you know, what they have on him.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think it was necessarily his enemies that put those things out there. It was the people that he's in bed with now, you know, because, and in a way, I feel sorry for these guys. Like, you know, they're just, any of these politicians or other sort of famous or, you know, quasi-powerful people that sort of get pushed out there and promoted, and you can tell they're being handled by the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
I feel sorry for them because they all have guns to their heads, basically, you know, and they probably already ruined
either.
Their lives. Yeah.
There's not one clean person out there.
I'm sure there isn't. Hey, Lance, I don't mean to, I hate to be rude, I just want to know, we're about to wrap this up, right?
Right. I could talk to you for hours. You're so much fun to talk to.
No, I don't mean to be rude. I think my son just woke up, though. So,
oh, okay. Well,
I wanted to know if...
well, this would
this
be
is one, this is a one-hour interview, so... Yeah.
Right. This would be a good time to, you know, any closing statements and let everybody know about your websites and the thing that you have going on with the books. I thought that was really great to sign all your books, so... you're on. This is your promotional time.
Okay. Yeah, so my website's TracyRTwyman.com. That's TracyRTwyman.com. And you can also go to TracyTwyman.com without the R in the middle. That'll get you there, too. And, you know, if you just Google my name, you'll find it. So all my books are there, and there's, at this point, I think six or seven, like, published ones. Printed ones, and then there's lots of ebooks too. But yeah, if you want to get the autographed ones, buy from my website. Otherwise, they're on Amazon too, and you can get it shipped to you faster if you buy it on Amazon. But if you want an autographed one, then buy it from my website.
Wonderful. Well, Tracy, I thank you so much for coming on, and as I said, I could talk to you for hours. We didn't get into the Merovingians or Solomon's treasure or anything else, so I will have to have you back someday so we can have another chat.
Sure, yes. Hey, thank you so much. It was a really good time, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again, Tracy, and we'll call it a wrap. And
awesome.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Tracy.
Good night, Lance. Thank you so much.